From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. Good morning. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Marvel's latest superhero installment, Captain Marvel, starring Brie Larson and Samuel L. Jackson, the romantic drama Gloria Bell, starring Julianne Moore, and the drama western The Kid. Those and many more movies coming up right here on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame. I'm sitting in for Larry Mantle today. For the next half hour, we'll be talking about new movie releases. And later in the show, Larry will be making a cameo appearance. We'll be running his interview with author W.K. Stratton, whose new book is about the iconic film The Wild Bunch. Joining us this week are KPCC film critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and CineGods.com and Claudia Puig, who is the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association. Welcome to you both.
Hello, sir.
Thank you.
So we're going to get started with the biggest release of the weekend. That's Captain Marvel. It's Marvel Studios' first female-led superhero film. It stars Brie Larson, along with Samuel L. Jackson, Jude Law, and Gemma Chan. Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck directed the film, which they also wrote, along with Geneva Robertson-Dorrit. Claudia, let's get the ball rolling.
You know, we were talking about this just beforehand. I really like a couple of the films that Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden have done. Much
maybe
different.
Not so much this one.
Not so much this one. I really liked Sugar, which was about Dominican baseball players. And I really liked Half Nelson, which starred Ryan Gosling as a coach and teacher. I will say that I thought Brie Larson was terrific, and I loved her rapport with Samuel L. Jackson. But I also felt that they didn't really establish her character. It felt like a onslaught kind of CGI, and you know, she had amnesia for part of the story, and they just didn't really develop that character.
Is that the part of the story you wish you'd forgotten?
Yes, I wish I'd had amnesia. She's great. She's a great fit for the part. She's plucky, but there's kind of this disconnect between this kind of what feels like a disorganized, convoluted plot and this kind of girl power story, which I really appreciated that part of it, but I felt like it was kind of pat and superficial, and I would have liked it to have been just a deeper, I mean, I realize it's a Marvel, you know, comic book story, but still, I just felt like it was a good cast playing empty characters.
I don't know. I like it more than you. I like it more than you. A certain amount of humor in this film that pops up in the Guardians of the Galaxy sort of franchise. You know, they're kind of funny over there doing that.
Yeah, they're funnier than this one.
Yeah, funnier than this one. This one splits the difference because there's a whole lot of business of Avengers business that's going on in this movie that they're bringing into it. Plus, you have this origin story going on, which is sort of complicated. First of all, to really freakish fans like me out there, there's a Captain Marvel and Shazam, and a kid named Billy Batson. And Shazam used to be a word that Billy Batson would say to turn himself into Captain Marvel. And all of that is very complicated and doesn't have anything to do with this particular movie. And there's another Shazam movie that's coming out later. But some folks have been wondering, wait a minute, isn't Shazam and Captain Marvel the same person? Well, they were once, but through some complicated machinations, that stopped in the early 70s. So this is a separate character. Now, I like this character. I like this movie. Because Brie is a square-jawed badass with a little snarl on her face.
That's why she deserves better. She deserves more character development.
I saw something going on in this movie that for one thing, she's in the United States Air Force, and you know, full disclosure, I was in the Air Force for six years, so I like her. I like her climbing into those F-16s. And this is what I liked about this movie. One particular set of sequences that I think this movie is really about. That sequence where she's a little girl, and they show her falling down, and she crashes the go-kart. And all of these things where she falls down and she gets hurt really bad. And then later in this movie, they show her getting up from every one of those events. And that's what this movie is about. Now, all the origin story and the Tesseract and all of these people, nothing to do with any of that. It's just like Black Panther. Black Panther isn't about the Black Panther. Black Panther is this conversation about the black community. This movie has something going on in it that's bigger than the standard sort of narrative that runs through all of these Avenger films.
See, I felt Black Panther definitely did, and I felt like that was a fascinating story. This just left me cold. I wanted more.
So in terms of how superheroes have been done before, so obviously this is Marvel's first female-led movie. They did do Black Panther, so we give them props for that. DC did Wonder Woman. How would you say it fits into those films about underrepresented superheroes? Is it at that level, or is it not quite there?
Not quite as good as Black Panther. No. It's not doing what the DC movie did with Wonder Woman. That movie isn't really doing anything other than being what it actually is in the context of the DC universe.
But that was sort of groundbreaking, too. Mm-hmm. So this feels like a little bit underwhelming because of those films before
it. How unfair is that, though? I don't even have to say it. You know, I mean, we can have Batman and Superman, and nobody says that Batman is diminished because Superman came before. And so I don't think that's a fair thing to do. Wonder Woman came first over in the DC universe. I don't think we should diminish this or that. Now, if you don't like it, you don't like it.
Wonder Woman had more backstory. This just doesn't have a well-developed backstory. I love the character. I wish she had been more. And I think Brie Larson could have done so much more if she'd been given more to do. Mm.
Captain Marvel stars Brie Larson and Samuel L. Jackson. It's directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. It's rated PG-13, and it's playing in virtually every theater in the free world. Now let's talk about Gloria Bell. The romantic drama Gloria Bell stars Julianne Moore, who plays the role of Gloria. Also in the film is John Turturro and Michael Cera. It's directed by Sebastian Lelio. He wrote the film with Alice Johnson-Bohr, and it's actually a remake, almost a shot-by-shot remake of Lelio's 2013 Chilean film of the same name. It follows Gloria, free-spirited divorcee in Los Angeles, who loves to dance and finds herself in a new romance. Claudia.
I love this movie, and I love the original. Yeah. And it's very rare that you can, you know, when they make remakes, it's oftentimes a pale imitation of the original. And, of course, when you have the same director doing it, that adds an extra layer. And he did a great job, and she's glorious. I mean, I really feel like Julianne Moore is just, she's always terrific, but she gives an especially terrific, well-rounded performance here. It's nuanced, it's vulnerable, it's strong, it's funny, it's emotionally rich and textured. It's a really complex character study, and we don't get enough complex characters, women of a certain age, women in their 50s. Woman at War was one of them a couple weeks ago. Now we have this one. I just thought it was great. She was the perfect person to star in it if you're going to remake that movie, because the original actress in the Chilean film was wonderful. And I like the way they adapted it for Los Angeles. And there's just visual poetry that Sebastian Lelio brings in. It's just beautiful. It really works. I saw it at Toronto, and then I watched it again just before this. It was the audience loved it. There was cheering. There were people like clapping along with the closing song, Laura Branigan's song.
There's a lot of great music in the song, but I think the fact that we're talking about it after Captain Marvel is noteworthy, because Gloria is not an extraordinary person. And we had Sebastian Lelio on The Frame recently. She's an ordinary person going through ordinary problems. Like, you know, what does her job mean to her? Is she going to find new love? What is her new boyfriend really like? There's nothing heightened about this. This is about ordinary life. And I think that's what makes it, in some ways, extraordinary.
Exactly. And it shows that if you develop a character well enough, an ordinary person can be just as compelling, if not more compelling, than somebody with superpowers.
Yeah, of course, was the case with that original film.
Yes.
Same thing.
Exactly.
Absolutely fantastic.
Exactly.
The problem with this movie is you can't start dancing when you watch it. There's so much great dance music, unless you're in that kind of theater where those kinds of things are accepted. Gloria Bell is the film. Julianne Moore is the star. Sebastian Lelio directed and co-wrote the film. It's rated R. You can see it at the Landmark Theater and Arclight Hollywood. Now let's talk about The Kid. It's a drama western. It's written by Andrew Lanham and directed by Vincent D'Onofrio, the actor. It stars Jake Shore, Layla George, Chris Pratt, and Ethan Hawke. Tim, you want to start with this one?
Yeah. Story developed by Vincent as well as being directed by him. So this is an interesting sort of thing when it comes to these kind of movies. This is what I would call a fairly middling western. It's not terrible. It's not particularly good. It's no Unforgiven, Pale Rider, nothing like that. Maybe Hostiles from a couple of years ago. But as I recall, growing up as a child, pretty much most Westerns were that way. And then you watched them and you enjoyed them. They were perfectly fine. Big shoot 'em up. This has far, far too many soliloquies in it. These grand, grand soliloquies.
Shakespeare on horseback.
Vincent was going for something absolutely Shakespearean. And aside from the fact that, generally speaking, most of these actors aren't capable of that, not Ethan Hawke, though, he gives great soliloquies. The material itself isn't worthy of it. It's just a brutal Western about these sort of, vaguely historical characters, because pretty much nothing that happens in this movie actually ever happened. I mean, Pat Garrett did eventually kill Billy the Kid, but other than that, they're making a whole bunch of stuff up. And I'll let you talk about that Spanish.
Oh, yeah. So the Spanish thing is interesting because Dane DeHaan, who plays Billy the Kid, should never be given Spanish to speak. I'm a native Spanish speaker, and I could not understand his Spanish. All the regular people who were actual Spanish speakers, I didn't need to read their subtitles. When he spoke, I needed to read the
Wait,
subtitles.
Wait, Billy the Kid is Spanish in this story?
He's got a Mexican girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so, but they give him these long soliloquies, again, to speak in Spanish. And not necessary. Maybe an occasional word would have worked, but he's incomprehensible. And it just hurts your ears. But that's a side point. For people who speak Spanish, they'll find it. Generally, it's just so overwrought and clunky. And, you know, if you're hankering for yet another story of Billy the Kid, I counted there have been 46 movies about Billy the Kid made between 1911 and 1999. So there was a 20-year gap.
Mm. So we're
here
ready.
You are. Yes, if you're hankering, this is it. I just felt like this was kind of a snooze. Chris Pratt as a villain was awful. He was kind of cartoonish with this bad beard. As you say, you know, Ethan Hawke is always good. Everybody else was serviceable at best. The cinematography was gorgeous. It looked like, you know, Western landscape painting. So, you know, Matthew Lloyd's cinematography, the New Mexican vistas are kind of these iconic Western landscape visuals. But other than that, there's really no reason to see this.
Old school gunfights.
Yeah, you have the worst of both worlds. You have kind of the old school story that you've seen a million times with the modern, you know, gunfighting. So it feels really brutal. And then the other thing I have to say is that women were just...
Oh, nothing.
Nothing. They were victimized. They were sidelined.
Which I suppose was a point he was actually making, Vincent. But he needed to make it while incorporating them into the story. Make the point about their victimization while incorporating them into the actual movie.
They exist only for men to come and rescue, basically.
Have it both ways.
Yeah. So you have this graphic violence, women treated terribly, and a lot of soliloquizing?
I don't know what that word is, but
anyway.
We have coined it, soliloquizing. Yes. The Kid is directed by Vincent D'Onofrio. It's rated R. It's playing in select theaters. You can check your local listings. Now let's talk about The Heiress. It's a drama from Paraguay about Chela and Chiquita, who are two, heiresses, whose financial situation takes a turn for the worse. And after Chiquita is imprisoned on charges of fraud, Chela is forced to provide a local taxi service. It's written and directed by Marcelo Martinizzi, and it's his feature writing and directing debut. Tim, you want to start with this
one? I like this movie so much. Set in about 1973 in Asunción, Paraguay.
Right.
And these two wonderful older ladies. And they are so funny. So she starts driving her friends around in sort of like a Uber or taxi driver, right?
Days of Uber.
And she meets this young woman, eventually, who sort of changes her life.
Well, we should say she had to do that because they were wealthy, but they came on hard times, and one of them ends up in prison.
In prison,
fraud.
They start selling their stuff. That opening sequence, when the lady's going through their house and he's looking at all, that was just absolutely hysterical. It's a very patient film, beautifully composed. I love the way he lurked with that camera, sometimes on the other side of a door or something like that, looking over their shoulders or when they would be in the car. And just these little tossed off lines, the things that they would say about people right after they got out of the car. It was just such human conversation and such a human situation.
And again, very ordinary people. Again, you have these women who are probably a little bit older than Gloria Bell, and you know, it's still in their maybe late 50s or early 60s, and they're ordinary people, and we find them really compelling. It also gives you a sense of sort of the social class system in Paraguay, which, you know, we don't see Paraguayan movies very much at all, so we don't know much about the class system there. I thought it was a really well-acted character study.
Yeah. And I assume the actors speak better Spanish than Dane DeHaan did
yes,
in The Kid?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
The Heiress is written and directed by Marcelo Martinizzi. It's unrated. You can find it in select theaters, so check your local listings. We're going to talk now about Juanita. It's a drama about a woman who's fed up with her deadbeat grown kids and takes a Greyhound bus to Montana, where she tries to reinvent herself. It's based on the book Dancing on the Edge of the Roof by Sheila Williams. It stars Alfre Woodard along with Adam Beach and Blair Underwood. It's written by Roderick M. Spencer and directed by Clark Johnson. Tim, what did you think about this Netflix production?
Middle of the road little movie, shades of how Stella got her groove back. Alfre Woodard is very, very good at it. Now, this is the interesting thing about this movie coming from my point of view. So this is a movie about a single mom of a certain age.
This is a good week for women in their 50s.
And she has this grown single daughter who herself is a single mom. And she has these two grown sons. This is a black family, obviously, if you know who Alfred Woodard is. This is a black family. These two grown sons, one of whom is already in prison, and the other one who is doing things that looks
half
like
a thug. She called him half a thug.
Half a thug.
I love that.
And
what?
I got to tell you, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I got to tell you, 9 times out of 10, a movie constructed out of these elements would be a movie that would be making me pretty mad. But somehow, Clark Johnson and Alfre are able to speak to these things that exist in the black community as they exist in the black community without making them feel like these stereotypes that are being heaped upon them.
Yes.
Because they are such sharp blades.
Juanita is a drama starring Alfre Woodard. It's directed by Clark Johnson. It's unrated. You can watch it on Netflix. Coming up, we'll review the German-French co-production Transit and the documentary Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People. And later in the show, catch Larry Mandel's interview with the author of a new book on the film The Wild Bunch. We'll be back after a short 1 minute break. You're listening to Film Week. Welcome back to the show. I'm John Horn. We're joined by our critics, Claudia Puig and Tim Cogshell. Claudia, you want to throw in a last quick thought about Juanita?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought, in addition to it being a fully drawn portrait of a middle-aged woman, again, there's a light and lovely romance with Adam Beach, who's seen far too seldom. He was so fantastic going back to Flags of Our Fathers. And you have a lot of Native American actors in this, and it feels natural, doesn't feel contrived, doesn't feel forced, and we don't see enough that of all the different minority groups, Native Americans are the least represented on film. So it's wonderful to see so many actors in this. It's well worth seeing.
Next up for review is the French-German co-production Transit. It's about a German refugee who flees to Marseille, where he assumes the identity of a dead writer and falls for a mysterious woman. It's based on a 1944 book of the same name. The film stars Franz Rogowski and Claudia Barr. It's written and directed by Christian Petzold. Tim, you want to go?
I like this movie quite a lot. The 1947 book, it was actually set in Nazi Germany. This is set contemporarily, and it's sort of vaguely a fascist takeover in Germany.
Kind of pre-apocalyptic.
Yeah. And all of these people are fleeing, and there's a situation where you have to have transit papers before you can move on to your next destination because nobody wants you to stop there, which, of course, was true during that period. So this young man, who through a twist and turns takes on the identity of this fairly noted writer, decides to use his papers to eventually make his way to Mexico. He finds himself being involved with a number of people, including this young boy and his family, and this woman who keeps running across him, and then eventually a relationship starts there. Now, this movie doesn't quite trust its audience enough because there's this voiceover that's in it. And we eventually find out where that voiceover is coming from. That voiceover needs to go away.
Yes. That was the only really negative thing about this film. I thought it was a really, really good film. Twists and turns are the key words here. It's beguiling. It's kind of a labyrinth of a movie. And the ground is always kind of shifting underneath, as you watch. But and the motives of the characters aren't always clear. So it does trust us in some respects with that. But then, that voiceover narration did not need to happen at all. But I love that it took this story that was set in World War II and kind of brought it into these vague contemporary times about this fascist threat. And it felt, it felt gripping. It felt like sci-fi, but it also felt it was making a statement about refugees, about displacement, which is very timely.
Mm. The drama Transit is written and directed by Christian Petzold. It stars Franz Rogowski and Paul Aubert, and it's playing at Lemley's Royal Theater. It is unrated. Now let's talk about Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People. The documentary Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People, is about a man you probably know best from the prize that bears his name. Anybody in this room who's won one? No show of hands, no Pulitzer. Claudia!
I was part of a group at the LA Times after the riots.
That counts. Pulitzer Prize winning Claudia Puig. Joseph Pulitzer transformed American media throughout his 4 decades as a reporter and a publisher. The documentary features archival footage and images from Pulitzer's publication, The World, as well as narration by Adam Driver. It's directed by Oren Rudofsky, who also wrote the documentary, along with Robert Seidman. Claudia, you want to start on this one?
Yeah. I what I found most intriguing was sort of the contradiction of Joseph Pulitzer, that he was the social reformer and a scandal monger kind of at the same time. And, you know, his name, of course, lives on as a synonym for excellence in journalism. But it's kind of ironic because
of that period of yellow journalism him and Hearst were going at it.
And I almost felt like, you know, I worked for USA Today for 18 years. And some of his, you know, he would say he was pushing for language that the masses could understand. And let's do a visual presentation. He would actually say, like, color, and I felt like
he was designing
USA
the front
Today.
Page.
Yeah.
Did you talk about charticles and like all this?
Pretty much. He'd say things like the facts, the color, the facts, and, you know, condense, and bait hooks, not with what you like, but with what the fish like. But it was an interesting topic. I didn't feel it was always a fantastically made documentary. It had those reenacted voices. So it had the voice of Liev Schreiber playing him, mimicking his Hungarian accent, which I found a little distracting. And then it had Rachel Brosnahan, Hugh Dancy, Tim Blake Nelson. I'm not sure we needed that. I thought Adam Driver's narration would have sufficed.
A fairly classically composed autobiographical documentary about this guy. A Hungarian came to the United States when he was 17, paid by a northerner to go fight in the Civil War for him. Which I thought was extremely interesting. Spoke three languages, none of them English. Didn't learn to speak English until after the Civil War. And first of all, let me say this. I'm from St. Louis, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which is one of the two primary papers that he started. The New York World was the other one. Most of this movie is about the world and everything that
it
went on
there. It starts
in
St. Louis.
And those battles. Half of the biggest yellow journalism battles that ever took place in this country, he more or less coined the phrase fake news, which is really, really interesting. Now, this is the thing. He went on to lament that. He came to realize that that was a big, giant mistake. William Randolph Hearst never did, and there's no prize named after him. He established the Columbia School of Journalism. He established the Missouri School of Journalism. So I think that we have to remember that there was that second act, or maybe third act, to his career. He was a Missouri state legislator. He was a lawyer. He was an accomplished man who I think actually earned the right to put his name on that prize.
And he got very involved in presidential campaigns. Of course, he could not run himself because he was foreign-born. But the fact that he also served in politics, it was like the line was a little more blurred in those days between, you know, a newspaper
he was
person.
St. Louis Post-Dispatch while he was in the United States House of Representatives.
Yeah.
And it was like, I don't know. You might be able to get away with that again.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, these days. But what I also loved was how he, as an immigrant, spoke to other immigrants, and he made the reading of a newspaper become habit. And it was so
among
essential.
Among the regular people, because before him, it had been a thing that only the privileged really
did. Right, and he was looking out for the little guy, even though he himself had become, you know, a multimillionaire.
As someone who still gets three newspapers every morning in my driveway, yay, I applaud that fact. Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People, is directed by Oren Radavsky. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Playhouse, Lemley's Music Hall, and Lemley's Town Center. Now, The Gospel of Eureka. It's another documentary set in the South. This film explores the meaning of belief in the worlds of evangelical Christians and drag queens. It's directed by Donald Mosher and Michael Palmieri. Claudia, what do you think of this doc?
I thought this was a fairly enjoyable documentary. Yeah. It was cheerful, and it's an intriguing portrait of this small town in northwest Arkansas. Eureka Springs has less than 3,000 people in it, and it's a home for some very religious folks, and also it's a mecca for gays. And so the film, of course, looks at how these worlds come together, and they don't collide as one would think, as much as they kind of mesh. And that's, you know, a nice surprise, and especially is kind of heartening for the times that we live in. You know, considering the polarized times that we live in, it's nice to know that, you know, people can get along. Having said that, I did notice that, you know, I actually went and looked it up. It's 93% white. And so they're, for a place that is about spiritual diversity, maybe, or lifestyle diversity, I wish there'd been a little bit more diversity in general. But, you know, because that's the place. So we can't change that. I thought it you know, followed some interesting folks. There was a transgender woman who found her home there. There's a longtime gay couple that are married that started up a place they call Hillbilly Studio 54.
Yeah.
That's the drag karaoke club.
And then there's that passion play.
And the passion play.
This is a town of about 3,000 people that built an amphitheater for this elaborate passion play that they do that seats 4,000 people. The town only has 3,000 people.
But everybody bring a guest.
People came in. People came in from
well,
all around.
Well, it is kind of a vacation spot for a local, regional one.
And they do this gigantic, elaborate with live animals and this guy that kind of looks like Jesus. And it's all very serious and very earnest and very earnest. And yet they do not reject these transvestites or transgender people.
Yeah.
It's just no rejection there at all. And that was just fascinating.
Well, and we know that, of course, there are gay people and transgender people and Christians that come in all kinds of, you know, there are all kinds of people who are Christians. But it's nice to see that those two things do coexist and that there's some acceptance between the two worlds that would seem to not, you know, accept each other. So I thought it was a very enjoyable kind of a crowd pleasing documentary. Mm.
The documentary, The Gospel of Eureka, is directed by Donald Mosher and Michael Palmieri. It's playing at Lemley's Glendale, and it is unrated. I'm Not Here is a drama directed by Michelle Schumacher. It stars J.K. Simmons as a man struggling with the tragic memories of his past. It's written by Tony Cummings and Michelle Schumacher. Claudia, what do you think of this film?
I'm a little mixed on this film, probably more negative than positive. J.K. Simmons is a fantastic actor, and he is really good here. He doesn't speak a word. And his performance is still eloquent, anguished, and moving. He's the reason to see the movie. He's almost always the reason to see any movie he's in. but the story's a little heavy-handed, and it's predictable. It's a little bit all over the place. It's about generational trauma. He's a suicidal alcoholic. He's beset with these painful memories, so there's a lot of flashback into those painful memories. His wife directed it, Michelle Schumacher. I think it's an interesting story, and I think that the young boy, Ian Armitage, who played him, is also sympathetic, but it's really kind of more of an actor's showcase than it is. That's where it excels. I don't think it holds together as well as a coherent story.
The drama I'm Not Here is directed by Michelle Schumacher and stars J.K. Simmons. It's playing at Lemley's Monica Film Center, and it's unrated. Let's talk about the film Walk Wide Ride Rodeo. It's a drama directed by Connor Allen starring Spencer Locke as a girl whose pro-rodeo career is brought to a halt when she's involved in an accident that leaves her unable to use her legs. It's written by Sean Dwyer and Greg Cope White. Tim, what do you think of Walk, Ride, Rodeo? And say that three times fast.
I'm not even going to say it once. That based on a genuinely inspiring true story, this movie is wildly uneven. Kind of a Lifetime Network, slightly faith-based sort of tinge to it, although very subtle about that. But I will say this about it. It has, over the course of it, several deeply affecting moments that are well-directed, well-acted, and move me to tears. As you said, an accident, a truck rollover throws the girl, the young lady from the vehicle, and she hits this fence. Now, if this story is told the way it actually happened, I have no reason to believe that it isn't. She is awake. She never loses consciousness through this entire period. From the time that folks start to arrive, the police arrive, they catch her. She calls her father on the phone. They do this.
She's pinned to a fence with barbed wire.
Yeah. He doesn't use any score in this moment. Did you notice that?
No,
you can,
I didn't.
You can hear
really
the environment. You can hear the crickets chirping. You can hear the engine running. You can hear. And it was just chilling, and it locked me there. And this movie does that about three times.
Yeah.
Now, it has lots of problems and issues. I'll say this about it, too. Missy Pyle, she impressed me. Playing the mom, Missy Pyle plays the young lady's mother, has a lot of clunky dialogue she has to spit out in this movie. A lot of people got a lot of clunky dialogue to spit out in
this
movie.
They do. We think of her mostly as a comic actor.
Yeah.
And she's really good in this, in some of the really emotionally stirring moments.
Yeah, yeah. And she manages to get this stuff out. Is it great? It's really a Lifetime Network movie.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's a good Lifetime Network movie.
I agree with you. That scene of the accident really got to me. It was done in a very, very vivid fashion. And I completely agree with everything you said. It's interesting how Netflix does these kind of Lifetime movies. And then they do they're so diverse in terms of their programming lineup. They do some of the best and then these.
Walk, Ride, Rodeo is the drama by Connor Allen. It's unrated. You can stream it on Netflix. We talked about a lot of movies today. If you're going to recommend one over another, Tim, what will you send people out to see this weekend?
I'm going to send people to go see Brie Larson in Captain Marvel, and I'm going to stand
by. They're
going
to go see it anyway.
And other than that, see the Joseph Pulitzer movie, that documentary, and understand exactly what yellow journalism is.
And Claudia, what about you?
Go see Gloria Bell. I think that's it's a fantastic film. And The Heiresses. We'll pick different movies, although closely followed by Transit.
Yeah, indeed.
So that's a good pick. That'll keep you busy throughout the weekend. My thanks to KPCC film critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com and Claudia Puig, who is the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association. Coming up, you'll hear Larry Mantle's interview with W.K. Stratton. He's the author of a new book about the iconic Sam Peckinpah movie, The Wild Bunch. We'll be back after this break.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
...1968 was a tumultuous year in America, including on screen. Sam Peckinpah's revolutionary Western, The Wild Bunch, was filmed during 1968's upheaval and tragedy. The violence of the Vietnam War and assassinations were reflected in the movie's shocking images. The Wild Bunch is a movie that shocks even those of us rewatching it today. In honor of the 50th anniversary of the film's release, journalist W.K. Stratton is offering new scholarship on the film. His book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film. Kip, good to have you with us today.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's go back and listen to a scene from the film. In this scene, William Holden, as Pike Bishop, reprimands his bunch for wanting to desert old Freddie Sykes, played by Edmund O'Brien.
What in the hell's the matter with you, old man? Leave him alone! He's gonna get us all killed. I'm gonna get rid of him.
We're not getting rid of anybody. We're gonna stick together just like it used to be. When you side with a man, you stay with him, and if you can't do that, you're like some animal. You're finished. We're finished. All of us!
I love that scene because, to me, Kip, that brings up the intensity of the film that's there almost start to finish. It was truly a revolutionary movie.
Oh, it really was. It changed so many things about how films are made, particularly in the way violence is portrayed. But it had a lot of other elements to it that I think that have really made it a classic. And these relationships between men and who aren't very good men at all. There's no one in a white hat in this Western at all. Far from it. These are bad, bad men who at the end do something to redeem themselves. And it's presented in not a very pleasant way, but a very realistic way that, as you said, really reflects the times that it was filmed.
Peckinpah himself was such a fascinating character. His early work in television and really coming up as the medium is coming of age, working in Westerns, moving to feature films. And I remember, you know, people sometimes ask, well, why some of your movies, particularly The Wild Bunch, so violent? And he mentioned Junior Bomber and said, well, I made this sweet little, you know, relational story. No one went to see it. But I'm a fan of Junior Bomber as well, which is probably my favorite or second favorite Peckinpah film. But he's known for this one.
Yes. And in fact, I think Junior Bomber is an underappreciated masterpiece of a film. Certainly Steve McQueen's best acting is in that film, and it is starting to get more attention these days, and I'm glad to see that.
I'm glad. Ida Lupino with
Ida Lupino's
comeback
great
as his mom.
Robert Preston completely out of type in the role that he plays and does a magnificent job. It's just a wonderful film. Cinema Verite filmed during the actual rodeo in Prescott. Yeah. Just amazing stuff.
And speaking of, you know, being at the scene where it's filmed, The Wild Bunch, filmed in Mexico, uses large numbers of Mexican actors in the film. Seems to me there it wasn't just the themes of the movie, but even how it was cast was a reflection of a change in Hollywood.
Well, I think so, and I think it actually was ahead of its time in that regard. The film was largely shot in Parras in southern Coahuila in Mexico, which was the hometown of Francisco Madero, the father of the Mexican Revolution. So the scenery you saw there was very significant in historical terms. A lot of faces of people from that part of Mexico just appear in this picture. It gets you a real sense of place that most American moviegoers hadn't visited before. And then it has a large number of characters who are from Mexico, and every actor who filled one of those roles was a Latino. Most were Mexicans or Mexican-Americans, and then Jaime Sanchez, playing Angel, was a Puerto Rican who grew up on Mexican music and Mexican film. So it was kind of a natural thing for him to take on this role. I can't think of a picture from Hollywood before The Wild Bunch that had that many Mexican characters that were all filled by Latinos, the parts. And that was really a breakthrough. And it's gone relatively unappreciated, I think. But it's important from that reason, that standpoint.
We're talking about the film The Wild Bunch on its 50th anniversary, W.K. Stratton's new book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood, and the Making of a Legendary Film. How much of an influence do you think Bonnie and Clyde was on this movie?
Well, it was a big influence. There was violence portrayed in Bonnie and Clyde using squibs to make gunshots look realistic. And then there was the ending sequence where Bonnie and Clyde meet their doom that was filmed in slow motion. And that was not lost on Peckinpah. He told some of his associates that he wanted to, quote, cut Bonnie and Clyde with his film The Wild Bunch, take it one step further. And he did. There's a lot more slow motion in The Wild Bunch, and it's used even more effectively than the slow motion in Bonnie and Clyde. And the squib technology, Peckinpah advanced that by squibbing an actor who was getting shot both in the front and the back so that you would have the impression of a bullet going through a body. And to make it even more realistic, they would put a little bit of hamburger meat on the squib on the backside of the actor. So you actually saw something fly out.
Like flesh leaving the body with the shot.
Right. And you know, Peckinpah never liked the way violence had been portrayed in all these Westerns, like Gunsmoke, for instance, where Matt Dillon killed dozens and dozens of people, and it never seemed to have any consequences. And he wanted to make violence seem real, that there was a consequence when you killed somebody, and that it was not pretty, it was dirty. And he was, I think, very successful in that.
Well, and you have a Hollywood that is trying to find itself. In previous years, box office had been in decline with television taking much of the audience. And how difficult a sell was it for Peckinpah to do a film with this much explicit violence? Or did the studio even know?
Well, the producer, Phil Feldman, was excited by the violence in it. He thought it was groundbreaking, Peckinpah and Feldman had their differences eventually, but in this regard, they were sort of on the same page. Feldman thought this was groundbreaking. This is a way to push the barriers of the 1960s. So his producer was all for it, as was the office in Burbank at Warner Brothers. They were okay with this. So he had support for what he was doing, which was kind of rare for a Sam Peckinpah film.
Pauline Kael, a big supporter of the film early on, obviously a very influential critic. But were there critics who couldn't get past the violence?
Absolutely. Perhaps the best known was Rex Reed, who thought it was a terrible movie, you know, should not have been made because of the violence. The reviewer for Reader's Digest wondered, should this movie have ever been made? However, they were offset by mostly younger critics like Roger Ebert, who proclaimed the film a masterpiece from the get-go, Jay Cox at Time Magazine, and others who saw that Peckinpah had really accomplished something special here.
The casting is such an important part of this film, and using actors like Bill Holden and Ernest Borgnine and others, you know, sort of later in their careers, this must have been a conscious effort. Was part of it, though, that was there any problem with casting for the film because of the themes it pushed?
I don't know that there was problems with casting the film because of the themes it pushed. The picture started out as project with Lee Marvin playing the lead in it.
Then
Marvin eventually dropped out. He was, of course, a close friend of Sam Peckinpah's and had worked with him before. And then they went through a number of actors trying to find a replacement for the lead role and settled on William Holden, who was in a pretty dark period of his life. He'd killed a man in a traffic accident while driving drunk the year before, and his career was headed south, definitely. And he needed something to revive it. And, man, the performance he gave in The Wild Bunch was just incredible.
Well, and then the film roles that would come after this, after the revival of his career through this film.
He became relevant to a whole new generation.
He did. Terrific actor. We're talking about The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film. Journalist W.K. Stratton with us to talk about his book, which is published on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the classic Western, which revolutionized the form. As we continue, we'll talk about the ways in which it did just that. You're listening to KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle as we enjoy music from the soundtrack of Sam Peckinpah's classic Western, The Wild Bunch, released 50 years ago this year. The new book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film, written by our guest W.K. Stratton. Let's listen to another scene from the film, this a bit of comic relief from Posse members T.C., played by L.Q. Jones, and Coffer, played by Strother Martin, as they fight over who they killed and who gets the victim's belongings.
You stupid damn fools! Why did you shoot this employee and let the others get away?
Why did you shoot the employee? I first shot kill this man right here!
Liar! He is shooting an employee full of holes. Why, I was dropping this band. And them others, too. Why, I must have killed all three of them.
You must have killed all three of them? What do you think you did? I bought that group on your spot.
Liar! Black liar!
You shouldn't talk like that to me.
I'm sorry. Come on, TC. Help me get his boots.
Peckinpah using humor, which maybe works all the better because of how startling the violence can be, Kip.
Yeah, and I think at the end, once the final shootout has occurred and the main characters are no longer with us, as the movie ends, there's a lot of laughter. And the message I took from that was, you know, the world is a hard place, and sometimes all we can do is laugh at our own foibles. It's like the use of laughter in the film is great, and humor. You know, Peckinpah was very well-read, very well-educated director. And he knew his Aristotle, and he also knew his Shakespeare. And he knew if you're dealing with tragic themes, you had to add some humor to make it work, just like Shakespeare understood that.
How Peckinpah had a number of personal challenges of his own. He died at the age, I think it was 59 when he died.
Correct.
So as a young man when he died. At this point in his life, with the huge responsibility of a large cast like this and a lot of complexity in the making of this film, what kind of shape was he in?
Well, he was already beginning to show the effects of lifelong alcoholism virtually. And he was having some health problems that he pushed through in order to get the picture made. He was proving F. Scott Fitzgerald wrong during this time in that he showed that America sometimes does have second acts. He had been banned from directing, essentially, by Hollywood.
Because of his behavior?
Because of his behavior, difficult to get along with in his drinking. And he suddenly had this chance to direct this picture, and Warner Brothers gave him this chance. So it was make it or break it time for him. And he came through successfully. So he did have a second act. And he went on to make some terrific films, Junior Bonner, one of them, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and revival of his career as well. What do you see as the immediate influence on other Westerns in this era where the Western itself starts getting perceived as a tired genre.
Well, I think you look at the other great revisionist Western from the time that came out a few years later, McCabe and Mrs. Miller from Robert Altman, an amazing film, an amazing feminist Western, I consider it. You look at that film and you can see the influence of Peckinpah, even though maybe Altman would never admit that. But in the scene in which Keith Carradine's character is shot down in slow motion and the whole way that is filmed, that's using a vocabulary, film vocabulary, that Sam Peckinpah created in The Wild Bunch. So you keep seeing this in movies going forward, particularly in those revisionist westerns of the 70s. These things Peckinpah just brought out for the first time in The Wild Bunch.
With the interviews that you conducted from people who were involved in the production, what was some of the sense that they captured of what the set was like on the film from day to day?
Well, it was intense. There was a lot of work. People put in a lot of hard hours in situations that were not comfortable. A lot of dust, a lot of noise, a lot of heat. Then at night, it would be, you know, as it is in the desert, it could be bone-chilling cold, all within 24 hours. Tough times. But Warren Oates articulated it the best, I think. He said, as soon as we got down there and started working, we realized we were doing something special. And everyone I talked to had that feeling that this was something special that was going on here. And they really, people from crew members through the actors, they did their best. And they, because they understood something was happening here.
And what did they say gave them that sense? Was it the chemistry of the actors? Was it the vision that Peckinpah had, his clarity? What was it that gave them this impression that this was going to be a film to make a mark?
Well, Sam certainly had a vision for this, and that it came out, and they knew that he was leading them in a direction. And then he managed to put together an amazing crew and an amazing set of actors who are all playing off each other. And they realized just how good they all were. And I think that's what really propelled them in the filming of this picture. And then afterwards, when Lou Lombardo and his other film cutters were working on editing it, they understood too. And they put their best into it, worked ungodly hours, you know, getting this thing cut. The picture has more than 3,600 edits in it, which is a record for a color movie. It's incredible if you think how many edits are in this picture.
It's still a record?
Still a record, as far as we know.
And did Peckinpah, was he heavily controlling the editing himself, or did the editor have much latitude on the film?
Well, Lou Lombardo had brought a lot of editing genius into the cutting room, but Peckinpah was there for the whole ride. He said he saw every frame of film shot for this picture, and there were miles and miles of film shot for this. But he was intimately involved, but he had this great partner in Lou Lombardo.
What was the response from the sort of American traditionalist Western, you know, the John Ford, John Wayne? How did they respond to this movie?
You know, it was really mixed. A lot of people saw this as the next logical step in the development of the Western. Others didn't care for it that much because they saw it as somewhat subversive. There was no one who did anything heroic.
Yeah,
really.
Who do you root for?
Right, right. You have the heroes, quote unquote, are really, really bad men. Men behaving badly, beyond badly. They're murderers. They're thieves. They're all of these bad things. And so it was really mixed in that audience, in that world. As time has gone on, you know, it's come to be considered in that world as one of the great classic Westerns, if not the best Western, which I consider to be the best Western myself.
It's number one on your list, above The Searchers or some of the other classic
films.
With
all respect,
Red River.
With all respect to those, the totality of the picture, I think it's just beyond them.
All right. Thank you so much, Kip. Appreciate your coming in, talking about this film, which, by the way, is on the American Film Institute's list of 100 best American films. Sam Peckinpah's classic of 1969 release, The Wild Bunch. W.K. Stratton's book, The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah, a revolution in Hollywood, and the making of a legendary film. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week, our critics, and me, Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us.